Ah, the crunch of a perfectly fried fritter or a well-cooked French fry, it really is something to behold. So simple, but not so really. There's a lot that goes into prep and production, but today's focus is on the cooking, the deep frying. Do you have a deep fryer at home? Do you deep fry anything? Deep frying is easier at home than it used to be. Even so, there are some good guidelines to follow for great fried food and preserving your fat for as long as possible. The Eating Liberty Podcast, food and freedom once a week for life. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. The Escoffier series continues with the conclusion of Chapter 7. Deep frying is the topic. Now, the topic might sound like I'm going to discuss all the many ways to deep fry. Well, maybe a little bit, but mostly it's a discussion about fryer and food management and being safe. Safe is a big deal, since hot fat can really burn. I teased a story before about fryer safety, so here it is. When I was in culinary school back in the early 80s, the chef instructors gave us a tour of the service kitchen. Now, that school served a full-service cafeteria lunch with some to-order cooking every school weekday. They showed us all the cookwares, including the fryers, on that service line. Now, the fryer fat at the time came in large cans, maybe, 18 inches tall cans. The fat inside was milk white and thickish. It kind of looked a little bit like Elmer's glue. It poured out of the can, but some of the fat remained inside because it was really thick. The easiest way to get the extra fat out of the can was place the can on a hot griddle and let the heat melt the fat on the sides of the cans, and then you just pour it back into the fryer. So Phil volunteered to stay and watch the cans on the griddle. And the rest of the class and the chefs, we returned to the prep kitchen. Not too long after we left Phil, he showed up holding his hand, which was red and blistered, and he was in great pain. Phil did as he was instructed. He poured the melted fat into the fryers, which were turned on. Now remember, these are cans. One of the lids from one of the cans fell into the fryer. It seems Phil reasoned that A, since the fat was still milk white, it was not hot. So B, he could reach his hand into the turned on fryer to remove the lid from the fat. Phil deep fried his hand within the first half of the first day of culinary school, and it stayed bandaged for the entire semester. Don't be Phil. Reaching into a fryer to get something out that doesn't belong is one more use for the tongs I despise. All right. Escoffier didn't have cans of processed fat of interesting origins. He had animal or vegetable fats. Now, it's not entirely clear to me what he called vegetable fats, and he doesn't reveal what he means in the text, at least not that I found. A hasty Google search found peanut oil, which isn't a vegetable, and rapeseed oil, which is, as two possibilities. He does refer to olive oil by name and cites it as a suitable oil for frying. And for those of you who are triggered by such things, extra virgin olive oil is also fantastic for frying. Not in the deep fryer. In Escoffier's kitchen, there was no deep frying machine. deep frying happened in a large pot on the stove. Now, you can imagine, such a contraption comes with a few risks. Burns of the cook and spilling oil, causing a big fire, as two chief issues. Today, many folks aren't too far from that. Granny, for years and years, deep-fried, except she called it pan-frying. Those fried green tomatoes and that fried chicken certainly qualify as fried foods. Of course, deep-frying means complete submersion into the hot fat. Escoffier's preferred fat of choice is rendered beef fat. For his kitchen, it was the best due to the price. He preferred the fat that comes packed around the kidneys, as that was cheaper, but also the best for rendering for deep frying. Now, interestingly, that same kind of fat, fat around the kidneys of the pig, produces leaf lard, which is the best for biscuits and pie doughs. Beef tallow, which is rendered beef fat, is available online. It comes in a bucket, and it's, the price is 20-something, the one I saw for a fairly big bucket. I don't use beef tallow for frying. I just don't do that. My oil of preference is peanut oil, because I can get it in the store, and no one here has peanut allergies. Frying temperature is a bit like baking. It seems nearly everything is fried at 350 degrees. Now, Escoffier calls the ranges he identifies as moderately hot, hot, and very hot. He offers some temperature ranges for clarification. Moderately hot is around 280 degrees Fahrenheit. Hot is 310 to 320 degrees, mostly he's doing Celsius, and very hot is 350 degrees. Now, it's important to note that he's referring to animal fats for those various temperatures. When any oil gets very hot for its specific composition, so butter and coconut oil are very, very different in composition, the surface of the fat starts to move. And so if we're looking at Granny's cast iron pan, she has, who knows, probably bacon fat. When any fat gets hot enough, it's going to start to sort of flow like it has a source of current inside, kind of like a lake or a stream would have a current. It just has this, it has movement to it. At some point, a haze of smoke might start to appear above the surface of the fat, and that is that particular fat reaching its smoke point. Now, animal fats tend to have a lower smoke point than vegetable or fruit oils, what? Olives or fruits, or nut oils like coconut. Vegetable oils, and really they mean seed oils, can reach and hold temperatures up to and exceeding 450 degrees, which is hot. So a deep fryer you buy for your home will have a built-in thermostat which probably stops at 375 degrees. Stovetop frying can easily reach those extreme temperatures and then some. Escoffier notes that except for whitebait, which we call smelt, there's no reason to fry anything at so high a temperature, but also remember, he's saying very hot is our 350 degrees. Regardless the fat medium of choice, it is very important to remember these few things. Fat expands as it's heated. All commercial deep fryers have a max fill line pressed into the fryer wall. Exceeding that by too much can have serious outcomes of the fat overflowing the edges of the fryer. I've seen some real boneheaded things in the restaurant world, and overflowing the edges of the fryer is one of them, because nothing you can do to stop it. Well, You can take the baskets out of the fryer, which will take away the source of the overflowing. But once hot oil has flowed onto the floor, you've got a big problem. The other boneheaded thing I've seen done is one guy changed the fryer and emptied the hot fat into plastic buckets. Well, you can imagine what happened, and it did. It's another story. Overflowing the edges of the fryer can happen on either those countertop fryers at home or in restaurants or on your Dutch oven on your stovetop. That's also a thing worth avoiding. When food is placed in the fryer, displacement will also raise the level of the fat. Wet food, frozen French fries, or fish or chicken, frozen or not, has a lot of water, and that can create a foam, which is bubbles, which will rise even higher than the surface of the fat and possibly run over the edge of the fryer or the Dutch oven. Now, if you're frying on gas at home with the Dutch oven, you can sort of see the next few problems that come if your fat overflows the edge of your Dutch oven. Those bubbles, that foam doesn't stay there long, but it doesn't take very much to create an issue. The only thing you can do to stop it is try to reach your tool inside the thing and lift out what's frying. But the easiest thing is just to avoid being put in this position. And that's the best way to manage your fryer. There is a practice for French fries that is a two-step frying procedure. The first step is to fry the French fries on low, maybe 300 degrees, for a few minutes. Time is difficult to provide since the amount of oil and the quantity of fries will impact how long it takes for those potatoes to become par cooked. This step is called blanching. Technically, it isn't blanching at all, but in French fry land, it's understood that that's what it means and that's what's expected. Now, I've already jumped ahead of the French fry procedure here. It isn't exactly necessary, but it's a huge help to soak your cut French fries in cold water at least long enough to wash off the surface starch. A little bit longer soaking will pull more starch out, which actually has the benefit of making a nice crispy outside and tender inside French fry. Neglecting that rinsing will cause the starch on the French fry to brown, maybe possibly burn, but certainly brown faster than the rest of the potato cooks, and you'll get a false reading of doneness from your French fry. Drain your potatoes well before you fry them. Even at 300 degrees, that water will make steam, and if your face is over the fryer, you might get much warmer, much faster than you prefer. Also, tiny droplets of fryer fat will rise out with the steam and coat your faces and glasses in a nice film of fat. Drain the blanched French fries and allow them to cool. If you have no other frying to do, it's just French fries, let them rest in the fryer basket as they drain over the fryer while the oil heats to 350 degrees. If you have other items to fry when the oil is heating up, if you have other foods to fry before the French fries, place the blanched French fries on a sheet pan. There's no need to refrigerate them if you're going to eat them imminently. So chicken fingers and fish fingers are in other thin kinds of foods like fried zucchini sticks or cheese sticks fry very well at 350 degrees. Chicken breast pieces, so if you do a chicken in 8-cut or if it's exceptionally big, you do a 10-cut, cut each breast into two. Blasphemy in some places, I know. Those chicken breast pieces, legs, or thighs will do much better being fried at 300 degrees due to the need for long exposure to heat to fully cook the chicken. Chicken legs and breasts and thighs will cook very nicely and get wonderfully browned and crispy at that low temperature because of the duration of time needed to cook the meat. And speaking of frying poultry, there's that Thanksgiving tradition of setting the backyard on fire with the turkey fryer. Now, no doubt you've seen the YouTube videos of accidental infernos, almost certainly from too much fat in the vessel and too wet of a turkey and possibly too much fat too. I've never fried a turkey, but I have eaten some. Tasty enough, but hardly worth the oil and the contraption for me to go do it. I am as entertained as anybody else by the YouTube videos, but my golly, the danger is immense. Breading versus batter depends on the thing. In many cases, I put the thing, chicken legs or chicken fingers or even fish, into buttermilk with seasoned salt and give that some time to marinate, then dredge that piece of food into seasoned flour or seasoned breadcrumbs. A more traditional breading procedure would be that famed, or infamed, I guess, three-stage breading process, which is seasoned flour, egg wash, and the final coating, either seasoned flour or breadcrumbs. Now, cornmeal would be a perfectly fine final coating, depending on your desired outcome and the thing inside the breading. As a practice, allow breaded items to rest on a wire rack for about 10 minutes. Store it in the cooler if the weather's warm. This resting process allows the liquid in the egg to really grab onto the outer coating, but also really grab onto the flour part. So you're really getting a good, those three steps become sort of one good coating on that thing. So this is giving us our best chance at a good coating. Some breading will come off in frying. It always happens. This waiting time just reduces that eventuality. Battered foods, tempura anything, or battered fish is an immediate fry. So you're dipping the thing in the batter and it's going into the fat. When you place a battered something into hot fat, don't hold it at 6 inches above the fat and drop it. That's the best way to fry you with splashes. So get the zucchini or blossom or whatever it is you're tempering or the piece of fish or chicken in the batter and lower it, the piece, into the fat and you'll see it start to bubble and sizzle and do those things and then get close and just let go of it so it just sort of gracefully swims into the fat. So no splashing is preferred. Battered items, you can only put two or three at a time into a basket. Now, again, depends on the size of the vessel and the basket and the size of the thing. But one of the advantages to slowly entering the what's called the chicken finger into the fat is as it starts to fry, as it's going in the fat, you're reducing the possibility of that batter grabbing onto the wire part of the basket and sealing itself, pretty much frying around the basket. Now it's really hard to get off. It's possible, but it's hot, it hurts, and you end up ruining your food. So there's more than a few reasons to just take your time and be careful. If you're frying on the stovetop, carefully place the breaded item or the breaded thing you can put into a fryer spider and then lower that into the fat, whereas in the fryer you would have the baskets out, put that those beef rollatinis or the chicken fingers that are breaded in the basket and lower the basket in. So stovetop is only slightly more challenging, but not really. Scooping foods, fritter batter or hush puppies, they can be scooped and then released right into the fryer basket that has been lowered or just right into the fat on the stovetop. One little trick that kind of helps is put your disher device, your scooper, into the hot fat, then scoop a fritter, scoop a hush puppy, and that sort of helps release a little bit. And about three scoops, it gets all gummed up anyway, so it only slightly helps at that point. The other thing in the fryer, in either case, either way you're frying, when you're doing fritters or hush puppies, the last one in has less cook on it than the first one in. So try to keep a limit on what's on there. If you add too many at one time, it's going to be really hard to figure out who was first in the pool, and that one may be overdone. So like six or eight at a time per basket if you're doing it in the fryer, so you can sort of make sure that everything is cooked at to the same doneness and not one of them is all doughy inside, because that's no good. Fritters and fries get removed to a metal bowl and seasoned. Now, you don't have to use a metal bowl. I've seen bamboo bowls, wooden bowls, sheet pans, whatever you got. I tend to use metal bowls for that. And season everything that comes out of the fryer, no matter what it is. Fingers of the various foods or battered foods get a metal wire rack, so the excess fat drains away from the food and it's not sitting in a pool of fat. And again, season everything when it comes out while it's still hot. The oil that's on the surface, which will end up going inside, yes, it does that, is going to sort of help hold on to the seasoning salt. It's not required, but they make a thing called popcorn salt, which is really, really, really fine. I just use like a regular... I don't use iodized salt, but like the blue can, that sort of crystal, it's big enough. That'll stick nicely. Maybe the biggest challenge to a fryer is straining the oil. It requires a large enough metal container and a suitable straining device. And as previously mentioned, metal is important. Commercial restaurant stores sell filter cones, which are basically large and extra thick coffee filters. And they also sell the contraption that holds that large, weird-looking cone. So you can drain your fat into this clean container. And usually, depending on the size of your fry, do it in one shot. When I pan fry, I usually, well, almost always, drain the extra liquid fat. Well, it's liquid to begin with because it's peanut oil. I drain that through a coffee filter resting in a hand strainer over a Pyrex measuring cup. Usually it's four cups. And all those little bits, either in the fryer or in the Dutch oven or in the pan fryer, those little bits of oil, of breading or batter or whatever it is, if it stays in your fryer too long, it ends up continuing to cook. And it can give the oil an off flavor. Foods fried in low quality oil taste like they were fried in low quality oil. And that's not food that's as good as it can be. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'm trying a new thing, which is adding the script, which isn't word for word, I did some ad-libbing, as a blog post on the show notes page. It'll be below the music banner. All the usual things will still be there, but that will be at the end. Now, I've been told by some people who think they know such things that extra content helps with SEO. Who knows? SEO is a moving target, but it's worth a try. Baking season is coming, so that means baking episodes. If you have something you've been curious to make but feel a little overwhelmed about, let me know and maybe we can make a show out of that. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.